In his house?
Call the House Judiciary Committee to order Thursday, February 2nd, 2012. There may be some movement on changing in the order here, but we're going to start out with 4023. The people that were in my office, there's some things we need to change with the bill. So you've got it posted for Monday, Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, everything that's on for today has also been rescheduled for Monday, plus a few other bills.
And we don't need to.
Chair, members of the committee, remember, it won't die, but if we have it for hearing today, we can just schedule for a work session on Monday, which means you don't have to take testimony, or if you have a hearing, you're obliged, even if it's a brief testimony, to take it. Right, Mr. Chairman, as a committee, you could probably have the same people just briefly come up, and they may even say they don't need to testify.
This they
shouldn't be.
Giving a false impression.
Probably not.
We're not doing policy bills.
Because we had a hearing yesterday, Mr. Chairman. I mean, unlike the Senate, the hearing yesterday was an official hearing.
Being as we don't have the parties here that are negotiating a little thing, and Chief Domenez has got to be part of that. We'll just roll this over until Monday. Then we have House Bill 4025. Open a public hearing on that. Mr. Hendricks, please.
Mike's the one way listening.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office. I presume you'd like me to explain a little bit on 4025?
Yes, please.
As you know, last session we passed a very extensive revision of the laws relating to fines that are imposed in criminal proceedings. Most of the changes relating to the fines that are imposed in violations, that is, offenses for which the only penalty is a fine. This bill was requested by the interim committee to look at some issues that had been raised with the implementation of that bill. There are three other bills that are also, one other bill specifically with respect to House Bill 2712, which was the offense bill that was passed, that's in Ways and Means, and I've been told it's already been looked at by a subcommittee. I'm told it'll be introduced by tomorrow, that's covering some of these same issues. Just so you know that that's out there, because I'm afraid there may be some confusion. It doesn't cover the same things. There are some more substantive things in here that have been requested specifically by local courts and by local governments relating to some of the provisions that affect those local courts. And looking at Section 1, that this is probably the most significant thing that the bill would do. Under the old law, before we passed 2712, and by the way, 2712 became operative on January 1st, so it has not been in operation very long yet. It's just getting started. It only applies to offenses that occur on or after January 1st for the purposes of these things, so you know, we haven't got any track experience yet with the bill. Under the old law, local courts were required to forward certain amounts to the state. They went to the Department of Revenue. Some of the amounts they forwarded went to other purposes. There were some amounts that went to what's called the law enforcement medical liability account, which was set up to help local law enforcement and state police to cover the cost of medical expenses for people they took into custody. There was amounts that went into accounts to help with courthouse security. There were amounts that were deposited in another account to provide security in the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. So there were lots of different monies that were coming from local courts, and they were coming from fine amounts that were imposed in those courts. And the biggest one was called the unitary assessment, which was primarily went into an account that was primarily used to fund DPSST, the department that certifies police officers, and This goes back a long, long ways that they've been collecting that assessment. I should say the other part of the other major use of that fund was to provide money for crime victim programs, et cetera. And local courts have been forwarding that in for a long, long time. On a violation, it was $37. On a most other crimes, misdemeanors, it was $67. On driving under the influence, it was $97. And then there was this other county assessment that brought in these other monies that I discussed that went to, like, the law enforcement minimum liability, et cetera, et cetera. So the Legislative Assembly, when they looked at this, when there was an extensive interim committee process that developed 2712, we're looking at trying to, A, get rid of the complexity was in the old system, but while maintaining the revenue as closely as possible that the old system used to produce. And since this was money that was basically being used, was really fungible with general fund money, the idea was that local courts would continue to send along, to the greatest extent possible, the equivalent level of revenues. But the old system was really complicated. It had lots of moving pieces, and trying to come up with an exact number was going to be pretty much impossible unless you maintain the complexity. I mean, those were two, you could not reconcile those two goals. And so the complexity went, and instead a single number was inserted for what used to be, you know, the different unitary assessments, the county assessment, which floated based on the amount of the fine, et cetera. There was just going to be one number that was to be sent in. And I believe you hopefully all got copies of the memo that I wrote that kind of gave the history of this and kind of reflected how long I don't know if your counsel, I think he was going to be emailing that out so that you could see it. And if nothing else, it'll show you how complicated it was because it's a long memo. But the number that they came up with for just replacing those amounts during the, and this was in the Ways and Means process, the bill ended up in Ways and Means, as you might expect, was $55 as being the amount. That was based on assumption that because, you know, we're not going to be doing 97 for DUIIs, we weren't going to be doing 67 for misdemeanors, that instead of the 37 we previously had for violations, we would go to 40 to kind of bring it up a bit to offset some of that loss. And then the other $15 was to replace amounts that previously came in under the county assessment. At the last minute, there was a decision made in Ways and Means last session to provide some funding for the courthouse's capital improvements, not security, which previously had been funded to some degree, but to actually get some money for doing something for some of the courthouses, which have a huge need. And I mean, the county courthouses, they did a study, I think it was about 5 years ago, in which they came up with numbers in the range of $600 million as being some of the basic needs for just getting courthouses in the 36 counties up. I should say court facilities rather than courthouses. There are a few additional facilities beyond the courthouse, but primarily the courthouses. So that at that point, $5 was tacked onto all of the fine amounts that they'd previously agreed to, and they also tacked it onto the amount to come for the courts, figuring that those amounts would also go to help fund some of the improvements to the courthouses. So that's how it arrived at $60, and on every offense, basically every offense in a local court, they were required before sending any money anywhere else to them or to the state or wherever the law otherwise provided, that they send along the $60 in lieu of what used to be the unitary sending to the county city. So hopefully that's helpful. The other thing I want to note about Section 1 is the new subsection 3. One of the issues this created was we do have a few offenses in which the amount that's on the ticket is smaller than $60. And so the local court would have been required to send in the full amount they're getting from those tickets to the state. What subsection 3 does is take those seven statutes, those seven offenses that provide for very small fines, and these are things like helmet law violations, there's the snow park violation, there's the invasive species permit for your canoe or kayak, you know, those small things, they would be able to just keep the amounts from those. And I think some of these make more difference to specific counties. Hood River specifically does a lot of snow parks, so they would have been affected with revenues if they were required to spend the full amount back to the state, which they were not required to do under the previous law. Section 5 and on is a little more complicated. It has to do with partial payments on tickets in local courts and also in the state courts with respect to what happens when someone pays less than the full amount on the ticket. So if they get a $200 fine and they say, well, I can pay $100 now, and the question is, well, where does the money go? And I, as I just said, $60 is automatically going into the criminal fines account. You got $40 left. Who gets it? My reading of the previous law, and I believe the Judicial Department's reading, has always been that those monies first go to the state. So to the extent, and this gets way down in the weeds, and I don't really want to go there, but, you know, who gets the money from a ticket in a local court or even the circuit court depends on two big factors. One is, you know, who's the officer that issued the citation and which court did the officer send it to? So if a sheriff sends a ticket to the circuit court, under the new scheme of things, and this is the old scheme of things basically too, the circuit court would first take the $60, send it off to the criminal fines, and then they'd split what was left and send half to the county. And as I said, when you have a partial payment and you don't have the full amount, the question is, well, who gets paid first? Under the old law, the state got paid first. What sections 5 and going down will do is create make it balanced so that if there's amounts owing to state, amounts owing to a county, it whatever's left over after the $60 and would be split 50-50. So instead of the $40 going to the state, $20 to go to the county, $20 to go to the state. That's a change in the pre-existing law, but that is what these sections would do. And then finally, we have Section 11, which is very simple. The bill eliminated for traffic tickets and for offenses, violations generally, the ability to used to have an option of either pleading guilty or pleading no contest. But from the criminal end of the things, there was no difference as far as the effect. Maybe you felt a little better pleading no contest rather than guilty, but the net effect was the same. You ended up, you were convicted and you had to pay whatever the fine was going to be. It did have an impact on civil liability, which, if you were not pretty smart, could have an impact on whether or not you that if you get a guilty plea on some tickets, that could come back in a civil action later on and impact. It could be introduced saying you pled guilty to this as evidence that you were in fact guilty and you broke the law in an accident, for instance. So the decision in 2712 was to eliminate the guilty plea altogether. The only option now on a ticket is no contest, pay the fine, and what we forgot to do was that the Violations Bureau language had language that talked about guilty pleas, and so all this does is simply eliminate that, substitute no contest preferences to clean it up. And that's it. Happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, briefly. No, Mr. Hendricks, you've done an excellent job as always, and really, quite frankly, this isn't related to anything you're talking. Well, slightly. Mr. Chair, we're sitting here quibbling about who's going to get the money from a parking ticket or a speeding ticket or an invasive speed ticket, whatever. And that's good. Whenever we talk about money, we fill the room. And all these people are doing their best to provide services. But I'm going to say this again and again. Unless we should never pass any health care or education reform bills until the governor signs a water and a timber bill. And if we don't do that, we are letting every person in this room down and every person in Oregon down. We're quibbling over who's going to get the money from a ticket for a muscle on their kayak. This is the height of absurdity, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hendricks.
done now. I wish you weren't.
How much time do we have, Mr. Chair?
Well, you're taking their time.
I'll occupy the room.
Dave Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, under Section 5, I just wanted to try to kind of clarify this a little bit. The 50-50 split after the $60, is there, I guess the way I read that is that the state would receive the first portion of the 50%, and then the respective court would receive the following 50%.
It's Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Representative Olson. The only time this is significant is when there's a partial payment. If someone just pays the amount that shows up on the ticket, well, you've got all the money. As a practical matter, that's what this, what's going to come in. You pay the $60, you take what's left, and you send it out. No problem. The question is when you get the $100 payment on the $200, because the fear is that you may never collect that other $100. So if under the law as it currently is written, the $40 goes to the state and the county's at risk that they may never get anything because that may be the last of it. This way they get at least the $20. So you know that if you split it under the proposal here, if you split it, they'll get the $20 at that point. If the defendant later plays the full amount, everybody comes out the same anyway. It's just partial payment scenarios that this addresses.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further, committee?
Thank you, Dave.
I'm going to call up Paul Snyder, Honorable Judge Lundhouse, and Jason Carlisle. And keep in mind, I think a lot of people want to pass this bill. If you talk, you may talk yourself out of your bill by taking the time up. Literally, I will drop the gavel.
You got a door.
So, say what you got to say. Make it quick. We also are going to have a meeting. We're trying to arrange a meeting. Senator Provansky is to flesh out a little bit more on this. It won't move today, but we want to make sure we get it right this time. Hopefully.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I'll summarize. Dave Hendricks has covered a lot of the issues in terms of history of House Bill 2712. Our concerns are that the projected revenues that were used as a basis for compiling the numbers that came up with the $60 are inaccurate. And the problem that would result is that the revenue streams for justice and municipal courts would be significantly adversely affected. This is of concern to us, I believe, to the members of the Justices of the Peace Association, the Municipal Judges Association, of course, others who will testify this morning. I just want to tell you that we've had a couple of calls, in particular from counties in which the Justice of the Peace term expires this year. And the concerns are similar. The Justice of the Peace is a constitutional officer under the Constitution. You cannot reduce the compensation of a sitting judge during the term of office. And so, therefore, if a Justice of the Peace district is to be terminated in terms of, if you don't want to pay somebody for doing nothing for 6 years, basically what you've got to do is to make that decision this year in those counties. And that's a significant concern. I won't take up more of your time. We had other comments, but I'll leave it to Judge Lemhouse to explain why the specifics of the bill are a problem, of House Bill 2712, and why this bill fixes it.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, I submitted a short statement that's in writing and attached some charts, or I should say a couple of three tables that illustrate the concerns with House Bill 2712 as it presently exists.
Can you state your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jad Lemhouse, Justice of the Peace for Linn County. And I don't want to take any more of your time than necessary. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have about either the statement or the chart tables.
Morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jason Carlisle. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I happen to be the
DA in Lynn County, and we didn't plan this, but our association supports the bill. For us, it's important to maintain our municipal and justice courts because they are a part of the criminal justice system and they help maintain public safety. If, because of revenue problems, they wither and die, those cases will have to go somewhere. The only place left is circuit court, and we're not keeping up in circuit court right now. So those cases will receive little, if any, attention, and they're being handled, and they're doing a good job with them in our municipal and justice courts. So we support it basically to keep people safe.
Committee members, you have any questions? They're going to let you off easy. Judge, we may be calling on you a little later on for some clarification. I'll have Mr. Taylor get a hold of you if we get that meeting this afternoon or Monday on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. I'd like to have Kevin Campbell, Jason Myers, and Daryl Fuller come up, please.
Good morning, Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'll also be brief in accordance with your request. We support House Bill 4025. We're deeply concerned about the impact of this on municipal courts and their viability moving forward. We heard loud and clear as soon as the bill was passed, there were problems. In addition to the reduction from the 60 to 45, there are some other important changes in this bill that clarify what was intended in 2712, in particular, making sure that parking fines are not included in the sweep of this. And so it's important that the bill go forward in all its parts, if at all possible. And I'll be glad to answer any questions and catch up with anyone offline if you need additional conversation on this.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff. I'm here representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and I will keep my comments brief as well. We're in support of 4025, and I think some of the other folks that have testified have done a good job of articulating those reasons.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Again, Sheriff Myers has done a great job, and if you have any questions, Mr. Campbell will be happy to answer them.
Gentlemen, when we passed 2712, a couple law enforcement officers up here were looking at whether or not when we reduced the fines and gave discretion back to the court, that we knew there was going to be a revenue impact. Do you have any way of monitoring with the courts whether the citations are going to come up now because the judges have some discretion and the officers would be less reluctant to cite people? You stop a veteran wearing his little hat and he's served and you want to give him a $280 ticket? No, you really don't.
Chair Krieger, I appreciate the question. We won't know that for a while because the bill obviously is just in its first stages of going into effect. But we did anticipate that adding discretion and reducing the bail schedule would in fact result in less warnings. We'll have to see if the reduction is enough to kind of accomplish what you intended, but we will see that soon. And it can be measured, and maybe Sheriff Myers can talk more about the experience on his level.
Yeah, we absolutely can measure it, and I think it is too early to tell, but we track all of the revenue from citations in our justice court, and so we're able to take a look at that information and we can report back.
Well, I imagine sometime after 6-8 months that this has been in effect, we might ask you to come back to an interim meeting and talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing. Mm-hmm. And as we had told you before, the mindset of the officer now has to get back to doing the job, writing the citation when it's warnings are fine, but when it's justified, because the court does now have the discretion to take the driving record and their financial situation, and he doesn't have to be the judge and jury anymore.
And I think that's something that we can message out through our associations to all of law enforcement in Oregon.
Committee members, you have any questions? Thank you.
Thank you for hearing the bill.
Got Scott Winkle, Bill Kirby, and Patrick O'Clary, is it? Please.
Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I am appearing in support of the legislation before the committee. Again, I will, keeping with the co-chair's wishes, I will be brief. I will simply say that the revenue assumptions were based on done downstairs in the LFO process, were proved to be not entirely accurate. They assumed some collection rates that we wish we had but do not. And with me today are some representatives of the City of Beaverton, their city attorney and finance director, who can expand on that.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Bill Kirby. I'm city attorney for the City of Beaverton. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 4025. In respect of your time, what I would tell you is that if you want to know about how this really affects a municipal court and a city, we're prepared to talk to you briefly about how that affects how House Bill 2712 has affected municipal courts. We are a partner with circuit courts. We carry a great load of cases, and we want to continue to do that to serve our constituents and all Oregonians. So we're in favor of the corrections that are made by House Bill 4025 to House Bill 2712.
Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick O'Clair, the finance director for the City of Beaverton. And representing myself and Mayor Doyle and the City Council, we are in support of House Bill 4025. As mentioned before, it's a little too early to tell the financial impacts to the City of Beaverton. But in general, what House Bill 2712 did for projected revenues for the city in our municipal court is a reduction of about 38%. And that's about $1.5 million to the city's general fund, which goes to pay for the court's operations costs, which is about $1.7 million, and our police officers, our police department, which is about $25 million. The court revenue to the city's general fund is about 10%. And so we're losing about 38% of that 10%, about $1.5 million. With the passage of House Bill 4025, that'll decrease slightly to about, I estimate, about 32%, from about $1.5 to $1.3 million in net revenue losses to the City of Beaverton. Now, what's not known at this time is what was mentioned before about the ability to maybe issue additional citations because the initial bills were greatly reduced from the previous statute to the House, to the requirements under House Bill 2712. But for the City of Beaverton, there will be a financial impact that the city will have to absorb within this general fund. We'll have to figure out how that plays out in the next budget year for this budget year coming up. With that, I also will submit some additional testimony for the written portion, plus a very detailed schedule of the status of the base fine under the old statute, under the new presumptive fines that were effective January 1st, what happens under the passage of House Bill 4025 if it does pass, and then a total financial impact to the City of Beaverton. We issued 21,975 violations last year, so we are very high volume municipal court, and that's where the generation of the revenues to the general fund equals about $5 million, and now it'll be reduced by about $1.3 million. With that, I'll entertain any questions of the committee.
Committee members, questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Also, we want to announce that the Council of Police Association supports the bill. They're not going to testify, I guess, but they do support what we have in the bill. Perhaps the revenue office, is it Malik? Is he here?
Mazen.
There, I got it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mazen, did you have a nice trip? See you next fall.
What I might ask you to do, of course, state your name and things, but you heard the testimony. If there's anything you thought you might add or clarify or if there was any misunderstanding of what you heard. We got a few minutes for you, please.
Co-chairs, for the record, Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, the guy with the easy name, I guess. When we did 2712, I understand there was no easy way to, how would you say it, bring all the data all together from the different places and be able to make pinpoint accuracy type of for each city or locality or county and so on. So a number of simplifying assumptions had to be made with certain types of parameters around the edges. Revenue neutral, not less money to the state, not less money to the counties, and so on. And under the circumstances, I guess that's what you have. Under this bill, of course, you're relaxing these assumptions. If you want to change those assumptions, that's your choice, and we'll try to find how that will impact the state funds or the state courts and the county courts and so on. But obviously, those assumptions are being changed at this time with this bill. That's all I need to let you know.
Any members have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm assuming this will go to Ways and Means,
right?
It
goes to Ways and Means, and we do have a little note on the fiscal saying that in Ways and Means, when any amendments or final analysis will be done, to tell us better what it does. So Ways and Means will be the one that end up dealing with this in the end.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on 4025, and we will have another hearing on it Monday if there's any amendments or paper or anything that we need to move before we move any bill. I'm going to go out of order now and have House Bill 4163 open for a public hearing. We have three people signed up, two from Department of Justice, David Factor, Larry Raff, and we also have a Marilyn Lawrence, PPST. It appears Representative Hicks has some interest in this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Representative Wally Hicks, Josephine County. Very briefly, I submitted this bill at the request of the courts. Great efforts have been made by the courts to make this a very focused bill, narrow in scope. I think it applies to three people at this point. The bill isn't a familiar area of law for probably most of the members of the committee, and so it probably looks kind of strange, but once the courts start explaining what this bill actually does, I think there's every reason to be comfortable that this is an appropriate almost fix and even a rather good thing that we can do to make the most of existing resources. So that said, I'm happy to take questions. And there being none, Mr. Chair.
Are they at any time
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, no, they're not. Not at this point, no. Largely because of the lack of DPSST certification and formal training.
It would appear with what you see happening in some of the other courts where juries and judges have been shot. I mean, you have an incident every year somewhere in this country, in fact, more than one. They get by the detection systems and things are happening in the courtroom that shouldn't be. Perhaps we need to have a discussion with the judicial branch as to how they view that and whether they would like to move forward with something if they need legislation to do it. But this calls for BPVST training, which deadly force when to do their job would be important for them.
Go ahead. Yes.
Okay. That's all you want to do.
Here.
Co-Chairs Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is David Factor with the Oregon Judicial Department. This bill was introduced on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department. It is very narrow, as Representative Hicks addressed. It allows for members of this security and emergency preparedness office of the Oregon Judicial Department to be trained and certified by DPSST, or for already certified employees of that office to be able to maintain their certification. Currently, DPSST, the Security Emergency Preparedness Office, is not an identified group who can be certified by DPSST, and so for employees of the office who have certification, their certification will lapse. And in fact, right now we have one member who just left yesterday to take a job with the City of Woodburn because his certification from DPSST lapsed. The focus of this office is while their duties are broad, their focus, generally speaking, is in the security for the appellate courts, in the Supreme Court building, and the members of the court, the public in those buildings, the Court of Appeals, and the Office of the State Court Administrator in the Justice Building. The training and certification is not mandated. It's permissive upon request of the office, and with as long as there's sufficient funds within the Judicial Department to pay for that. We've had the opportunity to speak with law enforcement agencies, and there's no opposition to the bill at this time. The Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police, the Department of Police Standards and Training, and the State Police. I'd be happy to answer any questions. With me today is Larry Raff, who's the Director of our Security Emergency Preparedness Office, and he'd be happy to answer any questions about the operations of that unit.
Committee, do you have any questions?
Just a second, please. Are the security people with the Chief Justice or certain members at different functions outside of the courtroom, out of the building?
Co-Chair Krieger, my name is Larry Raff. I'm Director of the Security and Emergency Preparedness Office. And yes, we have a contract with the Oregon State Police for a part-time trooper who provides that security for the Chief Justice as well as transportation to events.
So it wouldn't be these people doing that? Or would they be doing it in the future if they're certified?
Co-Chair Krieger, yes, these people could, in fact, do that function and replace that individual. And that would be a cost savings to us.
Okay, thank you. Anything further, committee? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, thank you. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. My testimony will be very brief. The Oregon Judicial Department contacted our agency a number of months ago regarding this concept, and we work closely together to ensure that the legislation that is before you today was drafted in a manner that the implementation by our agency would be seamless. The numbers are very small and well within the normal range of fluctuation that we experience in hiring or needing to schedule people for basic training. So if the Oregon Judicial Department did have an employee who required basic training rather than one who was already certified, we can readily accommodate these numbers within our normal schedule. There is no fiscal impact to our agency. The bill provides that the Oregon Judicial Department would reimburse us for any cost of basic training for those few individuals. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We do not have all the paper to move the bill today. It'll be carried over till Monday, see if we have it then. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4163. Open a public hearing on House Bill 4149. We have Jason Parks, Colleen, and I cannot read it. Tomei could be there for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, I'm Carolyn Tomei. I'm state representative from Milwaukee and parts of Southeast Portland. Thank you for scheduling this bill today. As you may remember, colleagues, we heard this bill, we heard this concept early in the interim, and we had quite a few people coming to testify. At that time, I think we gave you a packet of newspaper articles that have been put out. This had hit the front pages of several newspapers, including the Gresham Outlook, the Sandy Post, the Westland Tidings, Lake Oswego Review, Beaverton Valley Times, and the Portland Tribune. I've long been interested, colleagues, in public health and have worked for years to keep wellness a focus in our communities. From mental health parity to breast cancer screening, I am committed to making sure public policies support efforts to improve health and wellness. And it's especially true for me regarding children. Recently, it's come to our attention that although our laws prohibit tobacco sales to persons under 18 years of age, that law is not being enforced. Data indicates in 2009, 27% of Oregon 11th graders who reported obtaining tobacco were able to illegally purchase it from stores. In 2010, 19% of retailers in Oregon sold tobacco to minors. This is especially disturbing since in order to retain our full federal substance abuse prevention treatment block grant allotment, that's a lot of words, Congress requires each state to monitor the rate of tobacco sales and make sure that it stays under 20%. We are dangerously close to the limit, and we could face losing that federal money amounting to a cut of up to $7 million, which we cannot afford. Public health does not have the enforcement authority or resources for surveillance. So in searching for a quick and effective solution, I got a lot of calls, and I bet you did too, from my constituents after they saw these in these local papers. They said, what are you doing about it? So I and my staff worked really hard finding who could we find who would be able to enforce this. And what it came down, it was sort of a general agreement, that it could be the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. OLCC already has the structure and a system for doing minor decoy operations on retailers who sell alcohol, checking to make sure they don't sell alcohol to minors. So it makes sense that they could employ the same mechanism to enforce the age restrictions on tobacco sales. We've worked with the Oregon Health Authority, the Addictions and Mental Health Department, and also OLCC to draft this approach. The OLCC legal team has determined that in order to enforce tobacco laws, they need a couple of specific adjustments to the statutes. So Section 1 in this bill authorizes OLCC to apply for, accept, and spend dollars to enforce tobacco laws. Section 2 authorizes the OLCC to enforce laws relating to tobacco. And you should also have an amendment that adds an emergency clause so that OLCC can begin this important work immediately. And I want to emphasize two important points. This legislation adds no new regulations on the sale or the use of tobacco products. It only serves to enforce the laws that we already have on the books. This demonstrating compliance with the age restrictions on tobacco sales is necessary in order to continue receiving the full amount of the substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant general funds that we already get. And about $7 million, 40% of that block grant is currently in jeopardy. And I know there are others who are here to speak on this bill. I just wanted to get to one of the Pamplin Media Group is not the most liberal newspaper in Oregon. And the Sandy Post, in an editorial that they wrote in August, It's a long one, and I think we emailed you a lot of material. We get so much paperwork, and so I emailed you a lot of the materials from these newspapers. And the editorial says, if adults choose to put their lives at risk in return for the dubious pleasure of smoking, then that's their informed choice. But state officials should do all within their power to keep cigarettes or other forms of tobacco out of the mouths of children. Unfortunately, the state is not fulfilling its obligations. The state keeps track of how many retail stores make illegal sales to minors, but it doesn't issue citations when it finds such violations. It goes on to say, the goal should not be to employ police state tactics against retailers, but rather to protect people who are too young to make fully responsible choices about tobacco. The legislature, when it meets for the short session in February, should vote to require a full-scale enforcement program that holds stores accountable when they sell to minors. Other states have found that when they actually enforce their laws, teenagers suddenly have less access to tobacco, and that's hardly a surprising outcome. And it's one that Oregon must pursue for the health of its children. So thank you, and I'm open for any questions.
You probably want to get back up to your seat. Do you have any questions for the representative?
I like this seat, too. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Good morning, co-chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee. My name is Colleen Herman-Franzen, and I'm here representing the American Lung Association. The Lung Association is here today in support of House Bill 4149 because it would reinstate enforcement back into the tobacco retail inspection process and help reduce sales to minors. Just some brief background. In 1992, Congress enacted the Sinar Amendment, and this amendment requires states to pass laws prohibiting the sale and distribution of tobacco products to minors under the age of 18 and to enforce those laws effectively. It also creates penalties in the form of cuts to federal grants for states who go above the threshold for noncompliance, which is no greater than 20%. As Representative Tomei noted, the problem is that there is no enforcement of this law right now in Oregon, and our noncompliance rate has steadily increased to 19% in 2010. 19%, so we're very, very close to that 20% threshold. This is also more than twice the national rate. This bill would bring enforcement back into the inspection process, and it would send a strong message to retailers who are breaking the law that Oregon takes this law seriously. Along with my testimony, I also submitted testimony from Robert Gale, who is a retired Oregon State Trooper and a tobacco retailer inspection. He is just one of two part-time agents for the state of Oregon right now. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today because he does live in Coos Bay and wasn't able to travel, but he does strongly support this bill as a solution, so I hope you find his testimony interesting to get that inside perspective of what it's like to go out to these stores with the teens. Also noteworthy is that tobacco use rates among Oregon youth are on the rise. Again, Oregon bucks the national trend. Since 2005, the national rate for eighth graders, we're talking 13 and 14-year-olds, has dropped nearly 3 points to 6.5% in 2009. However, the Oregon smoking rate for that same group of eighth graders has risen to approximately 10% in that same time period. So that's a trend we would like to see go in the other direction. I also wanted to point out that House Bill 4149 will not cost Oregon any additional money. And in fact, I'll talk in a couple of minutes about why I think it will actually save Oregon money in the long run. First, the OLCC, as Representative Tomei mentioned, has the necessary infrastructure in place from their liquor inspections. So they are a very appropriate agency to do this work. The FDA, as she mentioned, has a non-competitive program for states to help them enforce the law. To date, 38 states in the District of Columbia have already participated in this program and received an FDA contract. We would like Oregon to join that group. The FDA's goal is to have a contract in every state, and we would like to support that. The National Office of the American Lung Association reports that the typical range of a state contract is anywhere from about $250,000 to over $1 million. Now, that, of course, depends on a state's population and the size of the state. But to give you an idea of the amount that we could go for, that is the range from the FDA. We've also reached out to partners in other states to learn about their experiences with the FDA contracts. And for example, I reached out to our partners in Idaho this past week, and the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare reported a very positive experience, and last year they were able to negotiate $113,000 for their state. Now obviously they have a lower population than Oregon, so they likely receive less money than we will. But that gives you an idea of what we can negotiate for. Finally, in closing, this bill is also good for the financial health of our state and very likely to save us money. As Representative Tomei mentioned, it's going to decrease our chance of getting penalized for going above that 20% threshold. In 1998, Oregon's noncompliance rate actually reached 29%. That's much higher than the 20% threshold. And because of that, the state had to take $1 million out of our budget and put that to tobacco control activities. And what they had to do with that money is increase the number of inspections so that we made sure to go below that threshold. And then finally, when fewer young people start smoking in our state, that's a good thing for the state. That means less hospital visits, a healthier workforce, and other future savings for Oregon. So in closing, I just ask that you support 4149 to help protect the youth in Oregon. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jason Parks. I'm the Oregon Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. We're the nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society. And I'm here in support of House Bill 4149, basically so it'll allow us to properly enforce laws that are already on the books banning the sale of tobacco to minors. It's my understanding that right now the two part-time people who are doing the inspections do not have the authority to write tickets, even if they see a retailer selling tobacco to minors. We have not issued a ticket here in Oregon since 2009, despite them seeing, quote, over 100 a year sales to minors. So we strongly support this, and it's a big deal for us to keep tobacco out of the hands of minors. Also, in the Oregon Tobacco Facts and Laws of 2010, 97% of people polled here in Oregon said that it was important for them, too. So I ask for your support of House Bill 4149, and I'm open to any questions. Thanks.
Committee members, you have any questions? Guess not. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do. I'm trying to get my hands wrapped around this a little bit, and I'm trying to kind of study all the letters that we've gotten here and everything. Okay, so at one point, Colleen, the state police were given a certain amount of money funded for them to go out and enforce this over the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
And then that changed to where you had, I'm reading this letter from Robert Gale, a retired member, and so apparently that went on until about 2 years ago, that you had at least some special status from the state police to enforce this. How many people were involved in it? It looks like it's two agents that were involved in doing the enforcement across the state.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and Representative Olson, I do not know before 2009 how many agents were involved. I know that since 2009 it has been, we have relied on the two part-time agents for the entire state of Oregon, which is not enough.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I think there might be someone in the audience who could answer that.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll have them come up now and just identify yourself and give us the information.
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, my name is Jeff Rusko. I'm with the Addictions and Mental Health Division. We administer the Sign-Our program that you're talking about now. Representative Olson, the project or the program for the Sign-Our amendment has had anywhere from two inspectors to as many as 12 over the 17 years that we've been running the program. Currently, we only inspect a random sample of outlets across the state, approximately 700 outlets. So two people are able to cover that over the summer.
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you. So are they able to cite them, give them citations if they sell cigarette to minors?
Co-chairs and Representative Tomei, currently no. The Department of Human Services and now the Oregon Health Authority does not have authority to write those citations. So our inspectors are only there as a survey to see whether the merchants will sell or not.
Thank you.
Follow up on that. Jeff, what was the reasoning or the rationale a few years back to change that structure?
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, the state police had done our inspections since the beginning of the program 2 years ago for reasons that only they know at this point. They pulled out from the inspection program and said they could not be a part of it. So we were left to find some other way to meet our federal requirement, which was to hire inspectors without the enforcement power.
That's interesting.
I wonder if anybody is in the audience who would know the answer to that, why the state police stopped, or the retired state police stopped writing citations.
I'll find out in the morning. The superintendent's going to be in my office.
Okay, terrific. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, another just follow-up to Jeff. What was the budget that was given? I mean, it sounds like anywhere from 2 to 12 inspectors, and that was. I'm kind of remembering that a little bit with the state police back, you know, well over 10 years ago.
But, sure.
Do you remember what the budget was?
Co-chairs, Representative Olson, when we were in full swing doing both sign-our inspections and then additional follow-ups to all of those outlets that were found in violation, we were close to about $150,000 per year. Over the last 2 years, we've been under $50,000 with our non-citation program. So because they're using less time to write reports, they're not stuck at an outlet once someone sells. They're in and out within, you know, a minute or two and on to the next inspection.
Mr. Chair, I just have one. I'm really curious. The program, when it was enforced by the state police, did you maintain the records of what types of citations were issued?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Okay. And it's a specific citation that's endangering the welfare of a minor regarding tobacco.
Do you ever keep track of the misrepresentation of age for those minors that would come in and try to purchase and using false IDs?
That part, co-chairs and Representative Olson, that part we do not keep track of. We actually just the sales that come to our minor decoys, and we do have full records from day one of that inspection program.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. The best way we can keep kids on the straight and narrow is make sure their parents have a job, and hopefully the kid has a job too. But when you say inspection, I mean the OLCC sends minors into stores and stuff to see if they can get served. Is that what you mean by inspection, or do you stand out there and ID people as they're coming out with a product in their hand?
Co-chairs and Representative Schaffler, no, it's identical to the OLCC alcohol inspection, where we send a minor in along with the adult inspector.
Thank you.
Well, Sam Whitsitt, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, did the grant, does it specify a certain percentage for inspection enforcement be spent?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, by the grant, our federal block grant does not require a specific number. It does have a formula as to how many outlets must be included in the random sample, and we inspect actually twice that each year just to make sure that we get coverage. Because we do not have licensure in the state, we don't know whether the folks that we draw from our sample originally will actually still be in business, whether they're still selling tobacco. So we oversample to make sure we cover for our random sample numbers.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Does your agency have an opinion of whether this enforcement evaluation should be held in the policy office like yourself versus a, another organization that's involved in enforcement like OLCC or the state police?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, unfortunately, we don't have a choice in that. It comes down as a federal mandate because we're the single state agency for alcohol and drug prevention and treatment. We get saddled with that piece. We don't have the enforcement power, so we do rely on enforcement agencies to be our arm of the law.
Did public health ever get involved?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, we work closely with public
health.
They
have enforcement.
And with the tobacco prevention and education program.
Yeah.
I think they fall under the same kind of issue that OLCC does in that they don't have enforcement power specific to these tobacco access laws.
Yeah, penalty.
It seems strange to me that you invest in inspections to the degree that you do, twice as many, have the information, and nothing's in place to do any enforcement. That's like sending a state policeman or a sheriff out to look at something, finding the violation, getting back your car and walking off.
Co-chair, that's exactly what happens right now, and it's because we don't have that enforcement power.
We have to do that.
Representative Hicks, you had a question, and I think then Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To dwell a little bit on the technicalities of the bill, principally for council, actually. OLCC derives its enforcement authority from licensure compliance, and currently I don't think there are licensure requirements to sell tobacco in the state of Oregon. Looking at the bill, I don't see a new licensure requirement for selling tobacco in the state of Oregon. So OLCC would have a bit of a shift in how it approaches this type of enforcement. I mean, typically what they do is they go in, examine whether someone's in compliance with the liquor laws, and if they're not, then they can yank the license. That's what OLCC does. That's my impression of things. Now, how are they going to enforce the tobacco laws, which are principally, I mean, there was the violations that they could, I suppose, issue, but then that kind of opens up a can of worms here because we're talking about, well, now we've sent them to DPSST. I mean, they're police officers. What's their authority to be there? I don't see any of that covered by what I'm reading here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hicks, you raised interesting and good points. I can tell you there's a bill on the Senate side that will require OLCC inspectors to be DPSST trained, as police officers are, and they will, and it clarifies what I think have been inherent powers since the end of Prohibition, police powers to enforce liquor laws. I don't know anything about the, I assume that you don't have to have a license to sell tobacco. My assumption is you probably pointed out correctly that it's a violation to sell tobacco to minors. I don't know whether it rises to the level of a criminal penalty. And my assumption is that, as you know, they would have the ability to enforce that as police officers if they had that authority to do so. And my assumption is it would be some kind of fine associated with that.
Sure. So, thanks. Yeah, the thing is, I mean, they're not police officers.
The judge.
They enforce licensure compliance. There's no licensure to sell tobacco, so I don't see us getting there. And what I'm reading here in the text of the bill, I don't see this getting us to where, I mean, we need more legislation if we're really going to do this.
To Chair's Committee, sure. Representative Hicks, if this were to pass and the other bill were to pass, and there would probably be need for a conflict amendment. In the sense that other bills should probably clarify that their authority to act as police officers would extend not only to liquor laws, but would extend to this area here. Okay? I frankly have not read this bill in the context of what their powers of police officers are. Okay? The said, as it relates to liquor laws, I think they have the inherent power to enforce liquor laws as police officers since the end of Prohibition. What that bill does is clarify exactly what their powers are and puts in every statutory provision where police officers are mentioned, liquor OLCC agents who have the limited purposes of enforcing liquor laws. But you have a valid point. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
We also have... the fact that we have tobacco settlements, we have huge tobacco taxes. It's not as if there isn't a stream of revenue from the sale of those products actually to have somebody actually do it, even if it was the state police going back to doing it, and those positions were funded if that was necessary. The sheriff, they all have that ability, I think, now, but not specifically. That's their sole obligation or assignment.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So I guess the way that I'm looking at this situation is, and Representative Tomei is exactly right, we have to enforce the laws that we have. And it's clear that they're not being enforced in the way that they need to be enforced. But the problem I have with what we're talking about here is we've cut the state police. We've squeezed them down. We've reduced the amount of support that we have for them. And they're the law enforcement community. They're the ones that are trained and are supposed to be there to enforce our laws,
Andy,
notwithstanding the federal requirements. And so having cut them back, we have this problem of not enforcing underage tobacco, which is a serious problem. So our fix to that is to shift that and empower somebody else to enforce it, that area. And I'm wondering why we wouldn't just go back and fund the state police,
exactly,
who have done it successfully in the past.
That's what we should
And it would seem that that would get us not only a benefit in underage tobacco, but also in other areas as well. And also, one last thing, and thank you. And I'm not being critical. Please understand that. I want to have a discussion, but I feel like this is the type of discussion that we should get some input from General Government Committee, the folks that think about the different departments and what they're all responsible for doing, people that have done a lot more of that than I have. Thank you, Mr. Kutcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The representative took the words right out of my mouth. I would just as soon, and I support putting this back in the hands of state police. And as you, a former Fish and Wildlife officer, you're out there in the bush. Not only are you enforcing the natural resource laws, you're also enforcing all the other laws. So you get two or three or five for one. And Oregon Liquor Control Commission, God bless them. I mean, it's a cash cow for this state. But as we've seen just north of us, that's on unstable ground. And there's going to be, whether we or I or you or support changing, it's going to come. I would much rather put it back in the hands of the state police. Then we have their eyes out there, not just enforcing this law, which I agree needs to be enforced, but a whole range of other laws as well.
Mr. Chair, could I suggest that maybe we have the state, you'll be meeting with somebody from the state police, maybe we could have another hearing on this and see if the state police are interested in taking on this responsibility?
I don't know, Representative Tomei, if we'll have time for all that. We get all the bills done, but having a conversation with them, getting ready for 13 as to what we maybe need to proceed, I think it's a little bit more complicated than what we maybe thought it was. We've got people here to testify yet today, so
okay.
You and I can talk about that.
Great. Thank you.
Co-Chair, there were several comments made. Could I respond to a couple of them?
Quickly, please.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Co-Chairs, I just wanted to get back to Representative Hicks. He's correct. We don't have a tobacco retail licensure in Oregon. I want to emphasize that we do see this bill as a very good first step in addressing the problem. We can't look into the future, is what I would say. All we can do is know what we know right now, which is we have a willing agency with the infrastructure in place through the OLCC. We also have a non-competitive source of funding from the FDA. So those are the comments I'd like to just share. Thank you.
Any further questions of this group? Okay, thank you. We have Brett Hamilton, and there's Raquel. And Raquel, I can't pronounce your last name. And then Sean Miller, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barker and Krieger, and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Brian Hamilton. I'm the Executive Director for the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, and thanks for having me here today. I'm here today to support House Bill 4149. Oregon currently does not effectively enforce the law, as we've heard, and ban the tobacco sales from youth. actually have no enforcement, and I'm not going to, I'm going to be very brief because I think Representative Tomei did a great job in covering all the pieces of this, and so did my other colleagues. I will state, as Colleen stated, that I do support the bold statement by Representative Hicks that where we need to be is to license retailers. That's not where we're at right now. So a step in that process protecting youth is to make sure we have enforcement. How the mechanism comes about, well, I think that's what we're talking about here. The ULCC has the infrastructure and has the means to do this, so that's why we're using that model. This is basically where we're at. Failing to enforce and minimum age law not only wastes constructive opportunity to reduce tobacco use for youth, it also tells kids the laws not be taken seriously, which undermines other tobacco reduction efforts in media, schools, and communications. And Representative Schaffler, I would state that to make our economy more prosperous, we need to make our kids healthy so they can go to school and attend school and actually be focused on what they should be focused on, not screwing around and buying tobacco from retailers. So that's it. Thanks for hearing me.
Good morning, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I'm Raquel Bornanes, co-director of Upstream Public Health, an organization dedicated to improving the health of all Oregonians. And I'm here to support House Bill 4149, which would authorize OLCC to enforce current laws around selling tobacco to minors. Our goal should be to prevent youth from starting to use tobacco. How important is this to us, to Oregonians, that we prevent kids from smoking? It matters a lot. A kid who starts smoking today has started down a dangerous path to a lifelong addiction, a myriad of health problems, and the associated costs. 90% of smokers started when they were under 18 years old. A shocking 75,000 kids now under the age of 18 in Oregon will die prematurely from smoking. Should Oregon be a state where we don't enforce our tobacco laws? What message does it send to store owners, and what message does it send to kids? Currently, the number one cause of preventable death in Oregon is tobacco. This simple fix can help change that. This committee can bring back enforcement of our state's tobacco laws and send a message that we value our children's health enough to enforce our laws. Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in opposition to House Bill 4149. But I do want to state for the record that we are very supportive of the adequate and effective enforcement, and that includes citation authority. So a lot of the discussion that I've just heard regarding law enforcement involvement in enforcement, we are 100% supportive of that and would actually like to work with the sponsors as well as the committee on trying to bring that back as an element, so enforcement is there and citation authority is there. With the state police issue not being involved, we believe law enforcement should be involved, and because of some of the other tobacco-related statutes, such as just having it being, it's illegal to have a minor in possession. And so those are issues where local law enforcement currently can enforce the current laws, and so having them involved and the state police involved, again, we are supportive of that and would like to move that. We are a little concerned with moving, I'm saying very concerned with moving this into the OLCC, and I've heard references that they have the means to take on this program, and I would just caution or question that. The OLCC has a very defined mission with liquor control. We work very closely with the OLCC, and this would obviously give them a new regulatory and enforcement authority. And so, again, it is, we believe, a pretty significant move to move it over there, given the current statutes on enforcement. And to illustrate that, because we do believe the bill is written to be duplicative, if you look on page 2, lines 27 through 32, when you look at the laws relating to tobacco,
There is other agencies that also regulate tobacco. And so we've talked, you've heard today, we've talked about the health authority, and we've talked about the SINAR and the federal funding that goes in for the stings. And obviously there is an issue with citation authority, and we're concerned about that. But there's also another agency, the Department of Revenue, who actually regulates the tobacco products as well. And it's something that we're very concerned about because they regulate the tax issue. But when people are selling tobacco, you know, out of the back of a store, for instance, a lot of that is getting into the hands of kids, and that's a concern of ours as well. And so when you look at, on lines 29, when you look at storage, transport, and issues within the store, those are currently regulated by Department of Revenue, too. And so, again, there's nothing in the bill that describes how this either falls in line with what OLCC would do under the bill and what Department of Revenue would do. I don't know, given the language of this bill. When you look at the purchase possession of tobacco products, obviously that is something that now the health authority has with the federal funding to do the stings. You know, again, we are very supportive, and I do want to reference a bill that we worked on and helped pass in 2009. It was Representative Schaffler's bill at the time to actually give further enforcement authority by the Department of Revenue to be able to inspect the premises, to inspect even off-premise locations such as warehouses, to make sure that the proper sale of tobacco products were taking place. That bill did pass. It did have funding attached to that bill. And so, again, looking at how this would overlap with some of these other current enforcement authorities is of question. And, again, I don't have the answers today because I don't know how it would work given those other enforcement authorities. But I just wanted to raise concern about shifting all this to the OLCC instead of trying to go after what the root of the problem, and that is using our existing federal money and figuring out a way to get better enforcement, which we believe is should be in the hands of law enforcement. I think Mr. Taylor raised an issue of some of the authority with OLCC and some of the questions I have with if the health authority employee doesn't have the ability to citation authority, what's the difference between an OLCC employee? Again, we know the state police and law enforcement should be there to because we know they have the authority and they can also enforce the existing tobacco laws. And so we're much interested in looking at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you, Sean, for coming, all of you, for coming to testify today. So, Sean, which grocery stores do you represent?
The Northwest Grocery Association represents chain pharmacy stores and independent pharmacy stores. So large chains such as Fred Meyer, Safeway, Winco, Albertsons, to the independent stores,
small stores. I talked with the representative from Safeway, and they were supportive of this bill because they said that when they find a person selling either alcohol or tobacco to an underage person, that person is fired on the spot. And they even gave an example of a manager of a Safeway store, I think in Eastern Oregon, who was found in a sting, and he sold tobacco or no alcohol to underage, and he was fired on the spot, which upset the neighborhood. But my point is, so you represent convenience stores, the little mom-and-pop 7-Elevens, those, right?
Some convenience stores, actually most of the convenience stores, I think you'll hear from the lobbyists who represents the convenience stores, too.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Tim Way, if I may comment on what you just said regarding you know, how seriously we take it. You're right. I mean, we take it very seriously in the training, to making sure that underage, you know, minors are not being sold these products.
But they are being sold, right? That's what
but,
we heard.
But again, in the training of that, if an employee actually does sell to a minor, I mean, we do terminate on first sale. And so that's how serious we take it. I mean,
Safeway does.
Yeah, and, well, a lot of our chains.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To clarify on the subject of the licensure, I haven't yet heard enough evidence one way or the other to make a policy prescription about licensure. I guess I'm just addressing the near-term question for today, which is that if the proponents are trying to make this happen, I'm not seeing the bill before us as actually able to do that. This is a huge issue that does delve into issues of licensure, delves into issues of OLCC's enforcement capacity. It goes back to what they can do according to prohibition, I mean, since then, and inherent authority. This is a major issue.
Right.
And this, so my reading of the bill is that I get your proponent, you want this, but I'm not seeing this bill actually achieving what you're trying to do. That's my, so I'm right now I'm feeling a lot more comfortable about looking at this in the interim if the proponents would be satisfied with that, because this is a big bigger question than simply just shifting one
Co-chairs,
function from one side of the government to the other.
Barker and Krieger and Representative Ickes, I accept your position as wanting to look at all parts of it. The fact of the matter is, for the last 3 years, no one's been enforcing. And I really question Mr. Miller's understanding of what enforcement and authority mean, and there's not three layers of enforcement. There is no enforcement of youth buying tobacco from retailers. I repeat, no enforcement. So we have a problem the last 3 years, and so we're going to send this room tonight. We're going to kick the can down the road and say we have to look at this further. Why we have our kids buying tobacco, which we know kills people. So I don't understand where the obstructionist is coming. We have a problem. Let's solve it. If this is not the way to solve it, let's sit down and figure it out. But for sit here and say, we're just going not to do anything, we're just going to kick down Camden Road, we're just going to let retailers continue to sell tobacco to youth, you're right. I don't accept that.
Mr. Chair. This is my 10th year here, and we've been kicking cans down the road ever since I've been here, and for 10 more years we'll continue. Lots of cans. So the bill you referred to, the inspector could walk into a store but couldn't inspect that room. And they'd have stacks of cigarettes and tobacco that they weren't paying taxes on. It was an absurdity, and God knows how long that went on. It was stupid. And believe me, there's no one in this room that wants children smoking. My daughter's never smoked. She's never been in a smoke-filled room. She's been on the deck with the old man smoking a cigar. That's the closest she's ever gotten. But look, everyone in here agrees we need to enforce the law. Everyone. But there's a question, who's going to do it? Once again, Mr. Chair, OLCC is on unstable ground. I'm sorry, they're on unstable political ground. They're a political hotcake. I love the department. They do a great job. I know they need more help. But who is going to say no to having the state police going out and do this? We have a solution before us, Mr. Chair. It's real easy. Let's just all get our shoulders to the same wheel and start pushing and go do exactly what you want to do. And at the same time, that police officer, well, if there's some freak on the corner selling dope and he or she sees it, they're going to go and bust them. So you get that benefit too. So I think we have a solution here, Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair, Representative Schaffler, that is correct. And if the state police was willing to do this work, we wouldn't be sitting here today.
Mr. Chair, the state police will do what we tell them to do. That's their job.
It's not their prerogative. This policy is made here by the superintendent.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair. I think a discussion has to happen, though.
And just briefly, I agree with Representative Ickes about the authority to issue citations. I know a man who was the deputy chief of police in Portland, Oregon, who retired, went to work for the OLCC as an investigator, and at the end of 5 years, he lost his police certification because you're not police in the OLCC. And I think we've reached pretty much a consensus how to fix this, but we can't do it today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to have Richard Kosas on, Daryl Fuller, and Mary Botkin come up, please.
I've never seen the bill.
You and me together.
This is scary, isn't it?
It is.
You're first.
Okay.
I bring Central Oregon's example. A lot of problems.
Chair Krieger and Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Richard Kosasan and I represent the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, which is a statewide organization comprised predominantly of small independent convenience stores. We would oppose 4149 for a variety of reasons, but I put together for information and future reference, outline of tobacco-related statutory provisions that we have on the books today. If you take a look at that, I believe that statutory framework is fairly comprehensive. Everything from the sale, distribution, purchasing, at nearly every level in the state. I would get back to one of the previous speakers who indicated that there is no enforcement at all. And I would respectfully disagree with that, because the state of Oregon annually submits a little report to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and it's called the Annual Sinar Report. And you can take a look at that. It's a fairly comprehensive report outlining the enforcement activities associated with tobacco-related issues. It's submitted by the state to the federal government. The most recent is in federal fiscal year 2012. But if you take a look at it, and if you would turn to page 3 of that report, state agencies responsible for enforcing youth tobacco access laws. And according to the state of Oregon, state police, county, and local law enforcement, youth tobacco access laws. So the report submitted to the federal government would indicate that there is enforcement. Coupled with that, I think you take a look at additional enforcement, which I think would prove to be duplicatory for those engaged in the retail level, between Department of Revenue and now the inspections, and layer on top of that OLCC. I think that is duplication, and I think that probably is not an efficient and effective manner for future enforcement. Get back to some of the concepts. One interesting note, it's clearly illegal for a minor in this state to possess or try to purchase tobacco. If we're looking at a balance, let's look at the retail responsibility and let's look at the youth access and the minor's responsibility. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
President Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard, could you please send me that report? The only materials I've seen, which I don't have with me right now. So this shows that there has been enforcement of this. Is that what you said, page 3?
It's a federal requirement, Representative Tomei, and that report is submitted annually.
Right. But it doesn't give any examples of enforcement, does it?
It indicates that the state conducts random inspections of retail establishments.
Inspections, but not enforcement, correct?
Inspections, correct.
Yes. A big difference between inspections and enforcement. Would you agree with that? So I think we've heard that they do 700 inspections a year, but there is no enforcement. That's what has been testified here.
With all due respect, Representative Tomei, I think they kind of go hand in hand.
Oh, absolutely not. No, in the inspections, they note that tobacco was sold to an underage person, but then they walked out. They did not do any enforcement. Nobody got fined for that.
Representative Tomei, I will follow up on that. That's
an
interesting question.
Thank you.
I should have maybe asked this of Mr. Miller. Mr. Cosan, do you have any data? A big problem, I think, in cigarette sales to underage is also illegal sales and internet sales. Is that true? Do you have any statistics on that?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, we can provide some information on internet sales. We can, just as a rule of thumb, minors in possession of tobacco predominantly obtain that tobacco through friends or parents. It's not at a retail establishment.
Is
Okay, Darrell.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We object to the bill on a couple of different grounds. The first being just the nature of this special session. We believe that any expansion of police authority is a pretty big deal and shouldn't be done in sort of a hurry, let's go attitude that this relatively short session has. We believe there are fairly substantial issues that needed to be addressed anytime you expand law enforcement authority outside of certified law enforcement officers. So if a bill of this nature is going to be addressed, we would prefer to address it during the longer legislative session. On a specific issue in the bill, we're concerned about the expansive authority on the last page to enforce all tobacco-related laws, as had been mentioned previously, as opposed to something more narrowly cast to just the sale of tobacco products to minors, perhaps. Again, if the legislature wants to make a policy move to provide tobacco enforcement authority to the Liquor Control Commission, we believe it should be substantially more narrow than the bill that's presented. And finally, just as a policy, we sort of object to the notion of expanding police authority to the OLCC on non-liquor-related issues, simply because they're the Liquor Control Commission, and we don't believe that it's necessarily within their responsibility to enforce other laws just because of the nature of convenience. We would tend to be more in favor of some of the comments that have been made previously, that if you're going to have law enforcement, it needs to be more law enforcement, it ought to be done by law enforcement officers. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the folks who work at the Liquor Control Agency, and we represent those folks who do inspections and enforcement of liquor laws. We're actually neutral on this bill. We will do whatever it is. Our members will do whatever it is you all decide is a policy for them to do. Having said that, I do want to say that, you know, the price of one of our members who enforces the liquor laws of the state are significantly less than the price of a state police officer. And so, you know, you need to think about how you want to do this and the budget constraints. Again, we will do whatever it is you want us to do, and we will do it with vigor and with commitment. But there's not enough of our folks to do liquor and tobacco. And so if you give us this authority, we will do it, but we will also be down in the budget committee asking for additional staff to get the job done. Because it's hard enough to do just liquor, and if you layer tobacco onto that, there's just going to be a need for more staff to do the job. And so having said that, you know, we are here to do your bidding, whatever that may be.
Any other questions?
Could I ask a question, Mr. Kosasan, please?
Absolutely.
Do we have other testifiers?
We have one more to come up.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kosasan, what proportion of cigarettes nationwide are sold in convenience stores and service stations?
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and Representative Tomei. I can get you some better numbers, but off the top of my head, you would probably have 55% to 65%.
I think it's considerably higher than that. My information is that it's 85%. And how much does the average convenience store take in a year for tobacco sales?
Co-chair,
you can get back to me on that one too.
Let me see if I can get some good information.
That would be great.
I think you'll have
information that it's almost $600,000 a year that they make off tobacco sales. So if you have other information, that would be great to know. Thank you.
I might buy a convenience store.
Oh, yeah.
Are there any questions for the committee?
No, I'm going.
Thank you.
Brian?
For the record, Brian Leishmidt,
members of the committee. I'm not here in an official position on behalf of the OSPOA, the State Troopers Association, or the OCPA, but hearing the discussion, I would be remiss if I didn't remind you the staffing of OSP, and obviously if you give them this task, they'll do the task. You guys are the policymakers. But if you recall, about the time that the shift as far as enforcement went away from OSP was the same time in which you were reducing their force. You had authorized a number of additional positions. Then you withheld 39 positions for 4 years now. And in the meantime, we have about 40 vacancies in OSP trooper numbers right now. They're not being filled because of freezes and the budget requirements to make a balanced budget within OSP. So I just wanted to, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind you continuously that OSP, as some members of this committee have said, have been stressed beyond the point of probably breaking. And this task, again, if added to them, they'll do it. They do what you want to do. That was my point.
Mr. Chair.
Brian, do you recall if they were in or out of uniform or sometimes in, undercover, walking in and playing clothes and making observations? Do you know how they were doing that?
I can find that out, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't recall because I didn't follow specifically this portion of how they enforced that statute.
We always talk about, well, it's going to be a revenue impact. If you look at the total amount of money that we're taking in on tobacco, if you can't find enough dollars to have a couple enforcement people, you already got the dollars. It's just a matter of taking that tiny little bit, and 35 cents isn't going to go to Curry County this year because of it. We're not concerned about that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I want to make it really clear that I'm not representing OSP, and at this point, I don't have an official position from the OSPOA or the OCPA on this bill. I was just using this as an opportunity to remind you about staffing in OSP.
Representative Garrett, you had a question?
Thank you. It's more of a comment. I've listened to the testimony this morning, and I got to say, this is obviously going to continue, and I appreciate you bringing the bill. I'm not persuaded by what I've heard that asking state police to take on this function is at all the best use of their resources. When we already have, it's true OLCC is on some shaky ground, as you said, but no matter what we do going forward, I believe there's still going to be an enforcement function for OLCC to monitor underage purchasing of liquor. And as long as we have state resources dedicated to that function, it seems to me it's far more efficient to ask them to add the task of also checking tobacco sales than it is to expect much more expensive state police to take on a function that, in these budget times when state police are already strained and when we're going to be asking them to take on even more responsibility as county law enforcement resources are diminishing. I am not persuaded by what I've heard this morning that that asking the state police to do this is the right way to go.
Well, Mr. Chair, once again, we have our funding solutions out there, and a majority of the members of the House and the Senate agree to go after that money. And you all know what I'm talking about. It's just a small group of elitists that stand in the way, and I'm tired of them. I'm tired of having this whole conversation. That being said, you get two for one with the state police officer. He's going to bust freaks when he or she sees them. Going to respond if they're out in the hinterland. And they hear the county sheriff in distress, they're going to respond. I think it's more efficient use of our state. And we have two agents right now who only go around and look for gray machines in bars. And they pull them out of the wall and they find it's a machine that resembles a lottery game. We have two agents doing that now. All they do is go to bars and restaurants, inspect. Can't tell me we can't hire two agents to go out and inspect to see if our children are being sold tobacco? And so it's efficient to go after gray machines, but not efficient to go after people selling tobacco to children. Look, no. And you get two for one. They're going to bust freaks. And we know where the money is, Mr. Chair. We all know where it is. And we need the governor to help us find it. And I'm sick and tired of quibbling over pennies. And I do appreciate my colleagues' efforts here. I definitely want to enforce these laws.
Just a comment, maybe. Didn't think that the conversation was going to be quite as in-depth as it was today, but I appreciate the fact, Representative Tomei, you brought this forward. and he definitely started the conversation. Everybody that's testified wants enforcement. They want it for the same reason, protect kids and health of people. Now it's the question is going to be who best fits that and how are we going to fund it? So I think that needs to be the conversation of your leadership on the Democratic side, the Republican side, and how do we go about getting this done. Difficult right now, and any bill that we were to send down there had a fiscal, pretty much dead meat, because you're going to have to find those dollars somewhere else in that budget. In other words, the budget we've all agreed upon would have to be adjusted, and that's going to be extremely difficult. So anything we send down there is going to be very hard to accommodate.
Just real quick, I just want to make, this is now 2 days in a row, I'm not on Ways and Means, as you know, but this is 2 days in a row, we're hearing about a core function of government that's not being funded, and yesterday we were asked to find the money. Well, there's a lot of places where there's money. We're paying money for the state to hire lobbyists to come in and lobby the legislature. We're spending money on advertisements for things that are luxuries. I mean, we have the money to spend on the core functions of government, including enforcing the laws that prohibit underage sale of alcohol or of tobacco, and we have to get there and spend the money where it belongs.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank both of you, both chairs, for being willing to take the time to hear this so thoroughly today, and I want to work with you both.
I think we've all, Representative Tomei, come to even realize today it's more important than we thought it was.
Yeah.
So that's a wake-up call. Good.
Well, I'm hoping we can work something out so that we can get a bill out.
We'll be looking at
possible.
What we can do. If we need to talk to leadership, I will.
Yeah.
And whether this is the right bill, this is the right time, but definitely we've got to find a process. I guess this is where we're trying to go.
Right. Thank you.
Anything further? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4149, and I believe we're adjourned.